First, it's time for our monthly check-in on the most intriguing stories from the science world. Today, quantum theory may not be at the top of your mind day-to-day, but it actually allows us to wake up and smell the coffee, among other things. We'll get very small with bacteria and viruses, and really big with a newly discovered giant dinosaur. Gemma Tarlak is the senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back.
Hello, and happy science.
Well, and happy science to you. And let's start off with, I don't know, the most sciencey of science, quantum theory, or the weirdest of science anyway. It's weird. When I try to read about it and understand it, it freaks me out. But an article in Discover says it's actually part of our day-to-day lives, maybe of how our senses operate. Weird? How so?
Yeah, and you know, the crazy thing is, I think when you say quantum mechanics to most people, they go, oh gosh, this is going to make me feel dumb. But we actually, the story in our current issue, it's really great at bringing home drinking your morning coffee is an act of quantum mechanics, okay? And let's start with, you know, let's say your significant other actually brews the coffee for you while you're in bed. So you're laying in bed, not quite awake, and then you smell that wonderful, rich aroma of your medicine. I mean coffee. And for some of us, it is medicinal, myself included. And
guilty.
Basically what's happening, the coffee molecules are wafting up to you and getting into your nose and leading your brain to register, coffee. But the question is, how do those molecules get from that delicious cup of coffee downstairs all the way to your upstairs bedroom, up your nose, and into your brain? And researchers think that is a quantum mechanics issue. So basically, to unpack it as quickly as I can, you've got these molecules, these coffee molecules, that are a specific shape. And it was long thought that they binded to specific receptors, like a lock and key, in your olfactory sense, in your sense of smell. And that somehow that got translated in your brain, from your nose to your brain, as, freshly ground coffee waiting for me. But now, people who study quantum mechanics are thinking that it's not just the shape of the molecules, it's how they vibrate. Because molecules are actually vibrating all the time. They're just jiggly little things, right? And it's actually the little specific dance they do that tells your brain, oh, coffee. So this is just one of a zillion examples of how you're experiencing quantum mechanics on a daily basis.
Yeah, and this piece gets into sight and touch. I'll leave those for the article, but one weird thought I want to leave quantum mechanics on before we move on. The idea that our senses intentionally disguise how complex the universe is. So we can't see the individual photons because our puny brains couldn't process it all if we got all that information.
You can't handle the truth.
Exactly.
That's exactly it. And basically, you know, they've done tests where can an organism gauge, say, the exact amount of water in a pool? And no, but you can gauge how much water you will allow you to survive. In other words, you know, if the water's too high, you're going to drown. So you can gauge things that are directly relevant to you as an individual surviving. And that's basically physicists think how we process reality. So we're not really processing reality. We're processing the version that, like you said, our tiny little brains can handle. So my tiny brain just blew up with that knowledge. But yeah, it's a really cool story.
Well, I'll pick my brain up off the floor now and move on to something that you wrote about, Gemma. This is amazing. Trying to find the DNA of viruses and bacteria to trace the evolution of diseases. And this is something up till like literally months ago, we didn't know if we could do.
Yeah, and you know, there's been a little work done. Like, I think most people are probably familiar with the genetic history of the plague pathogen actually being decoded, so now we understand a little bit better how great plague events such as the Black Death occurred. And when I say great, I mean huge, not great like woo.
Woo.
So,
yeah, no.
Yeah, but since then, two things have happened in the field of paleopathology and the folks who, the molecular biologists, who try to figure out the backstory of pathogens. And two big things have happened just in the last few months. One of them, we have this flood of ancient DNA from humans that is actually being put in open access databases that any of these scientists can go and use, which is a great, great thing. So we've gotten better at extracting and sequencing ancient DNA. It's now more widely available, so scientists from all over the world can access the actual genomes and data. And there's one more very important piece of the puzzle, and that is an explosion in these new software programs that can basically, I mean, not to bring up quantum mechanics again, but they process so much information. It, again, makes your tiny brain explode. And so they're able to process data that would have been impossible to process, even, say, a year or two ago, just because they're able to handle such huge data sets and do them very quickly, often in a matter of hours.
And so now we're able to go back, I don't know how far, and look at viruses and bacteria that we couldn't look at, you know, the ancestors of today's viruses and bacteria, and look at their DNA before.
Right. Well, for example, again, just a year or so ago, having a 300-year-old sample of, say, hepatitis B was a big deal. Oh, that was great. You know, it's 300 years old. We can learn something about the past of this particular virus. Well, in May, a study came out, and they were able to sequence genomes from several truly ancient hepatitis B virus samples, including one that was 4,500 years old. And I had an interview scheduled with the authors, and then all of a sudden another paper came out that sequenced a 7,000-year-old strain of hepatitis B. So, you know, day by day, they're pushing the time clock back further and further in terms of what they can see in these ancient pathogen genomes. So by the time we finish this interview, there'll probably be an older one out there.
Right. This is super interesting in and of itself. And it sounds like this could help us with the diseases of today, because it's useful to know how these things mutate, how quickly they evolve over generations. This could be practical knowledge as well as interesting historical information.
Absolutely. This is huge to the study of potential epidemics and outbreaks for two reasons. Bacteria, very, very tricksy things that actually steal pieces of DNA from other organisms and incorporate them into their own genomes. So they're always evolving very quickly. And viruses have this crazy skill to kind of resurrect big chunks of their genetic past and basically become something that they might have been in the past, if that makes any sense. Kind of like one of the researchers I talked to equated it to an elephant suddenly having a woolly mammoth head. So viruses and bacteria are both really good at using bits and bobs of genes from themselves or other organisms to evolve very quickly. But by seeing what they were like in the past, we can get a much better version of what they might become in the future, a much better vision of it. And, you know, hopefully epidemiologists and others can plan for that, whether it be developing vaccines or early warning systems for epidemics. So it's really promising. It's not just a history exercise. It's very much future-focused on tomorrow's medicine.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at intriguing stories from the world of science. Still to come, superstition and a dinosaur. Let's start with superstition. Gemma, Packer fan superstitions failed this weekend. Brewer fan superstitions succeeded. There's a lot of research out there, it turns out, on kind of our life stages of superstition. What do we know?
Yeah, and I just have to say, as an aside, that I really wanted to watch the Brewers games the last few days. I intentionally didn't, because whenever I watch a Brewers game, they lose.
Well done.
So, I want you to know that I made the sacrifice for the team. I did listen on the radio, though, which is okay. It works on the radio. It's just if I actually watch it on TV, the Brewers lose. So, anyway, don't worry, guys. Not going to be watching the Brewers on TV for the foreseeable future, if ever. But, yeah, so that kind of thinking, I know, even as I'm saying it, that that's totally irrational, totally crazy, doesn't make sense, not real. Get over it, Gemma, right? But the truth is that there's this period in our childhood when we're about 4 or 5 until we're about 9. I dare say I call it the Santa Claus years. And that's when kids are going to assign kind of like magical thinking, or, oh, that happened, it was a miracle, or that happened because I did this, when there's no link whatsoever. So we kind of outgrow it, but not really, because I'm sure everybody has, you know, that thing that they do, whether it's knocking on wood or carrying a quote-unquote lucky charm when you're going for a job interview, slipping it in your pocket, you know? So we all do those things, and the question is, why do we do it? It's because we have two different ways of thinking. One is very intuitive, very fast, you jump to conclusions, and the other is slower and more deliberate. So the slower, more deliberate way we think knows it's irrational, that there is no connection between what I watch on TV and whether the Brewers win or lose. I know that. The slow, deliberate part of my brain knows that. But that fast, jump to conclusions part of my thinking is like, oh, better not turn on the TV if we want the Brewers to win, right? So basically, we develop this kind of dichotomy within our own heads about we know it's irrational, but we still knock on wood or do whatever we're going to do, because every time we knock on wood and nothing bad happens or we get the job or whatever, we're reinforcing our brain saying, oh, I knocked on wood and the Brewers won, or whatever scenario you want to go with. What we should do instead, if we want to overcome this magical thinking, is pay attention to those times we do watch the Brewers on TV, or we don't knock on wood, and we see that the, you know, bad outcome that we feared doesn't happen. And so by reinforcing when your lucky charm doesn't work, or, you know, when a black cat crosses your path and you get to work just fine anyway, that's how you can retrain your brain to get over its irrational side.
All right, I promise people dinosaurs, Gemma, I want to get to that before we wrap up. New discovery, let's see, Ledu Mahadi Mafubi is the name.
Ledu Mahadi, yeah.
Oh, thank you. Is the name of this dinosaur. It's big. It's not the biggest, but it's a big deal. Tell us why.
Well, it was the biggest of its time, and that's back in the early Jurassic. You know, in the Cretaceous, which was after the Jurassic, all the dinosaurs you see in Jurassic Park, they were actually pretty much from the Cretaceous, but it's just really hard to say Cretaceous Park. So basically, you had the really giant, enormous, ridiculous-sized dinosaurs in the Cretaceous, but Ledu Mahadi is from the Jurassic, which came before it. So it's a much earlier dinosaur. And at the time, most of the dinosaurs running around were like the size of a mouse, maybe the size of a dog. They were not that impressive. Ledu Mahadi, if you can imagine it, was twice the size of an African elephant. So, comparatively, it was big. In fact, the researchers think this was the biggest dinosaur of its time.
And maybe it set the stage for the development of those really big guys later on?
Actually, it challenges how we thought the really big guys developed later on, because researchers thought that the really big dinosaurs first developed the stance where their legs were like columns directly under them to support their weight, again, like a modern elephant. And what Ledu Mahadi shows us is that it was possible to get really big without that particular posture and without the particular anatomy that researchers thought was necessary to bear that much weight. Ledu Mahadi actually had very flexible limbs and was kind of, you know, walking around with kind of, I imagine it sauntering, you know, with its knees and elbows bending, kind of like, you know, sauntering down the street, like, doop doop doop, I'm the biggest dinosaur. So, and that's exactly what all dinosaurs sound like, for real. But so actually the existence of this dinosaur, which was found in South Africa, and that makes it really exciting. That's a huge hotspot for paleontology right now. This dinosaur got as big as it did without the anatomical adaptations that paleontologists expect to find. So it actually challenges our ideas about just how big an animal can get.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Gemma Tarlak for the science and for the reenactment. She's senior editor at Discover Magazine.